Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools, VEA, teaching, learning, leading, online at veanea.org.
This is Assembly Conversations, the weekly broadcast looking at the hottest issues in Virginia's state capital while the Commonwealth's legislative body, the General Assembly, is in session. From Virginia Public Radio partner station WMRA, I'm Tom Graham, and this hour, as we near the close of this year's regular session, there is much to cover. Competing versions of changes to the state budget now being negotiated between the state Senate and the House of Delegates. How much funding will local schools get or not get? What's happening with all the additional borrowing Virginia's governor wants to do in order to pay for some transportation projects? Then there is the U.S. Justice Department coming down hard on the Commonwealth for some glaring inadequacies in Virginia's mental health system. And only, well, a few dozen other issues that are likely to be of concern to you because they will be affecting you and your community. 866-611-6397. The phone lines are now open. From Virginia Public Radio partner station WMRA, I'm Tom Graham, hosting this edition of Assembly Conversations. Here with me, Anita Kumar, Virginia politics reporter from The Washington Post. Shelley Ann Davis, politics and government reporter for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. And joining in by phone, politics and public policy specialist from James Madison University, Dr. Robert North Roberts. Anita, Shelley, Dr. Bob, thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you.
Hi. That was a delayed reaction.
So where is the most obvious place to start? The budget?
Sure.
Shelley-Ann, where are we with the budget?
We're about where we usually are at this time, which is they've huffed and puffed at each other a bit, and then they are now negotiating some of the larger differences between the House and the Senate version before they get in the next couple of days down to the smaller differences and hopefully get a compromise by Friday at the latest, I would hope, because we're supposed to adjourn Saturday.
Is the major dispute still over how much funding goes to local schools, K-12 education? Certainly where the Assembly and the Senate started on that was far apart, Anita.
That's one of the disputes. The Senate had put more money in for K-12 education than the House. The House had actually cut funding for K-12 education, but there are dozens of differences. Another difference is the Senate does not want to use any money from the general fund, which does fund education and public safety for transportation, and the House does.
Bob Roberts, do you see a biggest dispute looming as the negotiators from the House and the Senate try to come to terms on a budget?
It's got to be education. Let me explain why. What happened was that the state uses a composite index to allocate education funds. And something very strange happened over the last 2 years. The composite index score for Northern Virginia went down, which means they get more money, and it went up for rural areas like other areas like Richmond and Albemarle County.
So, is that composite index related to housing prices?
No, it's a number of factors. It's housing prices, it's income, sales tax receipts, about five different variables.
So it has to do with how much wealth is thought to be in different areas of the state, and based on that, how much need different areas of the state have for certain levels of school funding?
Correct. And what has happened is because the housing prices collapse so rapidly in Northern Virginia, that collapse is reflected in the composite index, which has about a two-year or three-year lag in it. And so if they go with the House version, what's going to happen is a lot of more rural or out-of-Northern Virginia jurisdictions will lose money, and Northern Virginia will get money. And that's not sitting too well in jurisdictions outside of the Northern Virginia area.
So what's the resolution? Is there one?
The Senate has a resolution by putting $100 million more into the budget. So that they are covering up that in a sense that little change in the composite index and holding harmless a lot of jurisdictions. And that's what that money is being used primarily. They'll hold harmless jurisdictions so they don't see a major drop in their revenue.
The Senate, of course, is controlled by a very small majority of Democrats. The
House has a fairly large majority of Republicans. Shelley, and I know that you've been talking to budget conferees from both houses. Have you heard anything about whether they're getting close to compromise on education funding?
Yeah, I mean, they're working on it. They told me both sides today, excuse me, in a general sense, said that, you know, they're making progress. I believe the Senate may have given a little bit on its education funding. I think the House has given a little bit on some other areas where they had devoted more spending, like you know, putting money in the rainy day fund. So it's the normal process of give and take in the budget conference, which takes several days. You know, it's negotiations. They're sitting around a table and they're negotiating. They're, you know, giving a little and taking a little and arguing a little.
And they're probably not revealing much about specifics when they walk out of those conference meetings.
I mean, you know, it depends. At this point, I wouldn't say I know a whole lot of the specifics of, you know, where they are. And also at this point, things can still change. They've got several more days. They have to, you know, fit all these puzzle pieces into one final product. And so, you know, things shift. Things can shift, you know, very quickly. But
this
on the
is the 11th session that you've covered now.
It is.
Do you see anything different or remarkably similar about what's going on here as we get down to the wire in this session?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually pretty much they go through the same stages. I mean, you know, they start meeting on Sunday, and, you know, for a couple of days they work around the edges on the big things, and they have staff working maybe on some smaller things. And there's always sort of a day and an evening where they argue with each other and they huff away and they're angry, and then they come back and they know that they need to get it done. It's different in the sense of that I've covered some years when we had major budget impasses over some revenue issues, with usually the Senate wanting to raise taxes. And with those embedded in the budget, that's the years when we wound up sitting here till May and June. I don't see that this year. I mean, if they go a day over, they don't seem to be too bothered about that. They did it last year. But I definitely think they'll get it done. And as they pointed out, this is amendments to the budget. It's not the full budget. So even if they didn't do anything, it goes, you know, we still have a budget.
Can you explain that, Anita? That has to do with a biennial budget system in Virginia.
Virginia has a two-year budget. So it was last year that they passed the two-year budget for Virginia. So we're already in the budget. We're already having a budget right now. So what happened was the governor, Governor Bob McDonnell, introduced a lot of amendments to this year's budget. And then what happens is the House and the Senate come back and then they have their amendments. They introduce their amendments, and they did a couple weeks ago. So what they're doing is they're...
And those amendments are to change things that are already
the
in the acting budget, mm-hmm. as Shelley was mentioning,
right.
that's
and
in
they,
effect right now.
Mm-hmm. And they introduce those amendments based on a revenue reforecast. So actually things are looking a little bit better in Virginia than they thought. So there's a little bit more money because there are more taxes came in. And they also base those changes on new priorities. How do they want to do things differently this year than they thought they did last year? So it's a combination of those things. So Shelley's right. I mean, they still have a budget. It's not going to change. What they want to do is change some things based on those, on both of those things.
The revenue forecast and the differences between the Democrats
new,
in the Senate and mm-hmm. the Republicans
new
in the
priorities.
House, what they want to make their priorities. And there are a couple, I know, other major things that all three of you have some analysis to offer that are budget-related, certainly transportation, and then this new quandary about certain aspects of Virginia's mental health system.
Right.
We will get to that, but now we're already starting to get calls here on Virginia Conversations. So let me remind anybody who's just tuned in that you also are invited to join the conversation as we take a look at what's been happening with the General Assembly and what's likely to be happening in its final few days of regular session. Our phone number is 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. First to Jinx in Stanton. Thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for our guests, Anita Kumar, Shelley Ann Davis, and or Bob Roberts, please.
Well, thank you. It's a little off the subject, apropos of what you're already talking about. But I heard something that was very disturbing yesterday or the other day from someone who lived down in Lexington. I live in Stanton, out in the county, in Augusta County. I've heard rumblings of this. I'm curious to know what's going on with natural gas mining in the state of Virginia. And ultimately, is my groundwater, is the aquifer in Augusta County going to be polluted by fracking fracturing in Northern Virginia or in Rockingham County.
Bob Roberts, have you been following this at all?
Yes. I mean, that issue has been generally in terms of giving special use permits.
And, Bob, hold on just a second. You're there in Harrisonburg. We're here in a studio in Richmond, and I want to let the controlling studio in Roanoke know that, at least at our end, Bob's volume's a little low, so we want to make sure our audience can hear him as well. But, Bob, now go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's in terms of whether you could drill for that in Rockingham County or in Augusta or Lexington, Rockbridge County, would depend upon whether special use permits are permitted and whether the State Water Quality Control Board would authorize it. So I'm not sure. I don't believe the legislature, I may be wrong, I don't think the legislature is considering any legislation one way or the other on that subject.
What I heard was that the monster Cheney, Dick Cheney, right. when they had their energy meeting, right. made sure that the EPA could not intervene in this matter.
That issue has been subject to state regulation and local regulation.
So Virginia sovereignty has control over what can be done?
What do you mean by it? It's up to the state whether to allow that drilling.
Okay, and ultimately, if you know, 60 miles away
right.
from some drill,
right.
My water is polluted, will I have recourse? Or is my life going to be ruined? Like there's this documentary called Gasland.
No, in Pennsylvania they've had that problem, in where they've had water pollution, and that's being litigated up there extensively.
And what do you think will be the outcome?
I have no idea how Pennsylvania law would deal with that. In other
well,
words,
well, if anybody watching this, because I mean,
they're very it's of great concern in Rockingham County. I know that the Board of Supervisors have been very concerned about it. I think in most counties, the Board of Supervisors have been very concerned about it. So I haven't seen any massive drilling occurring in Virginia yet.
And Jinx, I think part of what we're hearing from Dr. Roberts is that at this point there isn't any permitting process going on that would allow it in your area, that the industry hasn't jumped through the hoops that they would have to jump through yet as far as state regulation. Now, if I'm remembering correctly, the delegate in your area in Stanton and Augusta County is Republican Dickie Bell, and the state senator from your area is Republican Senator Emmett Hanger. I've talked to both of them about this issue in the past, and they've demonstrated some concern and reservation about ever allowing this to happen. But if you wanted to pursue it further, I would suggest getting in contact with either or both of them. And you can find, this is true for everybody in the state, you can find your delegate and your senator just by Googling Virginia General Assembly and then going to the Virginia General Assembly main page and following the very obvious links there to tell you who your state senator is, who your House of Delegates member is, and what their contact information is. But Jinx, thank you so much for bringing up that interesting issue. Phone number is 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. Our guests, Bob Roberts from James Madison University, Shelley Ann Davis from the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, and Anita Kumar from the Washington Post. I'm host Tom Graham, and I believe next we are going to Fern in Roanoke. Fern, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
My question is, the people who are familiar with the FCIC, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Report, Commission Report, I'm wondering if there has been, as far as you know, a groundswell to hear the report and act on it. I mean, I understand that this was more or less of a diagnosis, and what we need is the treatment, such as a firewall.
And I'm sorry, Fern, what report? Fern, can you hear me? What report are you talking about?
I'm talking about the FCIC, Angelides Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report.
And is this, as far as Virginia government is concerned?
Well, this is a this certainly with the foreclosures, with the financial crisis that we've had, Virginia has participated in this a lot.
Bob Roberts. Are you familiar with what Fern is talking about?
I know what she's talking about. In other words, there have been a series of reports mm-hmm. regarding regulating the mortgage industry and the financial industry regarding what led to the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. that has been dealt with primarily through financial reform legislation passed by Congress, mm-hmm. and the state legislature has had little involvement with that. In other words,
thing that might relate, Shelley and Anita, to what we're hearing from Fern is that there had been some activity earlier in the session to sort of change the speed at which homes could be foreclosed on in Virginia.
That's right.
One of the concerns was that in Virginia, present law allowed homes to be foreclosed upon pretty much faster than most any other state in the nation.
Really, really quickly. But all of those bills have died.
So we're not changing that process.
That's correct. Both the House and Senate killed those bills. All of those bills had died very, very quickly. You were right that Virginia was one of the very, if not the quickest, was reported to be one of the quickest states that you could foreclose on a home here in Virginia.
So, Fern, I have this feeling that maybe we danced around the issue that you were bringing up, but it sounds like it's mostly a federal issue, and we may not have the expertise to go further. But tell me if you've got one question that you're still trying to get answered.
All right. As far as economic recovery for our state, okay, this would mean that, I mean, we can't do it by ourselves. We cannot do it without, whenever Philip Angelides was involved with the Enron crisis, do you remember that,
California?
Yes, of course. Okay, well, he went to the federal government because his state couldn't do anything about it. You know, there are so many of the states, including Virginia, we're looking at the dichotomy of shall we increase taxes or shall we cut services? Okay, there is another way. Looking at the Angelides report that says, okay, we don't have to do either one of those things. What we need to do is get about 6 million jobs across the country and put people to work and provide ourselves with a tax base that will enable us to have universal Band-Aids or whatever our health care program is going to be. We can afford it. And right now, we cannot afford.
It sounds to me, Fern, like one of the things that you're saying you're in favor of is more government activity, including at the federal level, to support creating new jobs.
Well, there is a project called NAWPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, that was shelved back in the 60s when the Vietnam War was requiring a lot of attention, and it has been taken up now in an effort to get jobs for people, which would mean a lot. For example, over there in Norfolk, where the Ford plant closed, I was over there, when they were closing, people for generations had worked in that plant. During the war, they didn't even make cars there. They made airplanes. They made tanks, whatever. And we've allowed our industry to be shipped overseas or closed here, you know, and our workers are just, they're overwhelmed. They're just disheartened with not having productive jobs. And so,
Fern, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us. I apologize for cutting you off, but I think we hear your point of view, and we still have several other callers to get to before we hit the next break, so I do want to thank you. Next on the list here, we're going, I believe, to Amherst. Rodney, thank you for joining us on Assembly Conversations. Your question or comment for Anita Kumar from The Washington Post, Shelley and Davis from the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, or public policy specialist Bob Roberts from James Madison University.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the show. My question is maybe not as far afield, but still outside of what's happening during the session, other than I'd be interested in the perspective of your panelist on the Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling and Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, who's had the better session, and if there anything in the session that indicates whether one, both, or will be running for governor in 2 years, and if who has the upper hand in that.
Anita Kumar from The Washington Post, you may be the only political reporter in Virginia who believes that Ken Cuccinelli has very little, if any, interest whatsoever in running for governor.
I'm the only person in the state, maybe, who believes Ken Cuccinelli is running for re-election.
You're as Attorney General.
In this room.
What?
Since you're the only one in this room that thinks like that.
I, as far as the session goes, Of course, Bill Bowling, as part of his job as lieutenant governor, presides over the Senate. So he is, you know, intimately involved every day with the Republicans in the Senate, in their caucus, in their legislation. He's just much more involved in all of that. He's actually had, I believe, twice this session had to have a tie-breaking vote on a couple bills, at least twice. So, you know, I don't know if he's had a better session, but he's just been much more involved in session. The attorney general, of course, is not involved in the day-to-day goings-on of session. He has a completely different job. He has a legislative package, but you know, he has some bills that he's submitted, I guess, if you will. But it's just a completely different job. So it's just two different things. It's hard to compare. The lieutenant governor, as you know, is has not filed paperwork, but has pretty much said he's running for governor as the heir apparent to Bob McDonnell. Attorney General Cuccinelli has not said what he's running for, but has said before that he would like to run for re-election. Some people say he's going to run for governor. Some people speculate he might run against Senator Warner for Senate.
Although he said pretty conclusively that he is not going to run for Senate.
No. He said he's not going to run for Senate.
Oh, in the – right. The most – what's the term? Not the most recent, but the most upcoming, the 2012.
Right.
You're talking about the next Senate race after that. Yeah,
some people speculate he might run against Senator – Mark Warner in 20, whatever that would be.
Far in the future.
Yeah.
Shelley Davis, the new job that the governor gave the lieutenant governor as the job czar for Virginia this year, has that raised his profile significantly?
I mean, I would think so, yeah. You know, I believe he's been traveling the state a lot under that umbrella. And he's been very involved in a lot of those efforts. And I think it has raised his profile. You know, the lieutenant governor does not have a lot to do. In Virginia, he runs the Senate, and the Senate's only here 6 weeks this year. So as far as the official duties of the job, you know, there's not a lot to it. So giving him something else to do, of course, is going to raise his profile. And to get back to, you know, him running for governor, my understanding was that was the deal between him and McDonnell in 2009 or 2008 or whenever they
decided to run for the Republican nomination.
Right. Yeah. They both wanted to run, and McDonnell stepped aside in favor of McDonnell. I mean, Bowling stepped aside in favor of McDonnell. And the deal was Bowling's running the next time, probably with promise to backing for McDonnell, although I don't know that for sure.
But nobody was predicting a Ken Cuccinelli phenom at that time.
Nobody was, but, you know, I mean.
Rodney, have we addressed your question?
Yes, I really appreciate it. Enjoyed discussion. Great.
Thanks so much for bringing it up. Bob Roberts, can we talk about transportation?
Sure.
What are your thoughts on what the governor has proposed and what the Senate and Assembly are likely to do with it, especially in terms of increased borrowing in order to pay for transportation projects?
The borrowing is controversial, but the way politics play with an election where all the senators and House members are up in 2011, they'd like to go home and show their road projects. So I guess some of them are holding their nose about borrowing and going ahead with it. In terms of diverting money out of the general fund to pay for transportation, I doubt the Senate's going to cave on that. They don't want to go down that road. And among all the other compromises they might make, I don't think they're going to make that compromise. So,
well, I have to say that's going to be one.
This is Anita, by the way.
This is one of the big sticking points between now and the end of session Saturday.
Between the Senate and the House.
The Senate's not going to. They're not going to cave, but.
And the positions right now is the Senate does not want to take money out
they
of the general
zero,
fund.
They want zero, but the House wants, what, $150 million?
Yes, but I will say that has been the Senate position for years.
Right.
They are adamantly against taking general funds for transportation.
Right.
So I would suspect that the House argument is that this is surplus money, that it's supposed to be used for one-time things. You can't devote it to ongoing and recurring expenditures anyway. So they'll probably have to find some sort of compromise in how they define the money, and then.
Last week in an interview, the governor said he would not accept zero.
But I will say the overall package, the borrowing, the $4 billion or whatever it is, that is pretty much done.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some irony here that Republicans who talk a pretty consistent storyline about being fiscally responsible, and certainly in the House have a long history of any kind of tax increase. In essence, they're saying, well, okay, we'll go ahead and borrow a bunch of money and let people have to pay for it the next generation.
It's not inconsistent in terms of the Republican Party since the
1970s. Oh, Bob Roberts, we can just barely hear you again. Okay. We need our technician to pump your volume way up.
Okay. It's not inconsistent since the 1970s, where Republicans have, after the Byrd machine was forced to abandon pay-as-you-go, the Republicans strongly backed the idea of borrowing money so they wouldn't have to raise taxes. And based on the theory that you could get economic growth that could reduce a significant amount of revenue, that would pay back the bond. So the Republicans have been quite consistent, really since the 1970s, in supporting rather large bond issues.
I will say also the Democrats have given them some cover on this. I mean, I think Senator Ed Houck of the Senate, one of the Democrats, I think he's one of the co-sponsors of the bill. I mean, he was one of the group who went to New York and talked to the bond rating agencies about how this would affect Virginia's bond rating and was told it would be fine. And so he's been pretty gung-ho about it. And so,
But you don't see anything inconsistent between a party line that says fiscal responsibility is our biggest priority, and we certainly are not going to raise taxes, and then go ahead and borrow record amounts of money?
I think it's inconsistent, but
you don't think the Republicans think it's inconsistent?
Oh, no, I think they do. I think there are a large number of Republicans who think it's inconsistent, but they're not going to deprive their governor, who may be running for vice president, that victory. I mean, he already had trouble with the alcohol privatization. And to not let him get his second highest priority would be devastating for him. So I think they had to hold their nose and support him.
Okay, Bob Roberts has just thrown out, Anita, two things that we have to touch on
Before
we hit the break. We got the vice presidency as a possibility now, and we've got whatever happened to privatizing state liquor
stores. Well, which
stores.
Do you want to talk about first?
Let's talk about liquor first.
Okay.
Demon realm.
Well, the governor's priority last year for many, many months was that he wanted to privatize the liquor system in Virginia. So Virginia controls the hard liquor, sales of hard liquor, retail, wholesale distribution. And up until maybe the first day of session, it was a huge priority.
And he came out with about three different ways of doing it, All with the idea that you would get a one-time bonus of however, hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on who was estimating, that would go to transportation.
Right. It changed. All of the plans changed. And in the end, he
you hear that music?
Yeah.
That means we got to pause.
Okay.
So we're going to finish talking about liquor stores, and they're not becoming non-state-owned anytime soon. And then we got the vice presidency to discuss. We've got the mental health stuff to discuss. And we've got this phone number, 866-611-6397, for anybody listening who wants to raise an issue about state politics and what's going on in the General Assembly and what you'd like to see your lawmakers doing more or less of.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Assembly Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Since the mid-1990s, Shelley and Davis has worked for newspapers in Charlottesville, Lynchburg, and southwestern Virginia. But for almost 10 years now, she has covered state government and Virginia politics for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. Bob Roberts is the author of numerous books on American politics and ethics, as well as an attorney and a scholar. He teaches politics and public policy at James Madison University. Anita Kumar began her newspaper career in Charlottesville, then on to Lynchburg, Greensboro, North Carolina, and St. Petersburg, Florida, before getting back to Virginia 4 years ago for her current job covering Virginia politics for The Washington Post. We're hoping she's going to stay for a while. This is Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm host Tom Graham. By the way, you can find more information about this show, previous broadcasts, and other statewide news stories at our website, virginiapublicradio.org. But right now, we're hoping to hear from you about any concerns you have dealing with state politics and state lawmaking as the General Assembly is moving into its final days for this 2011 regular session. Phone number is 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. Anita, you want to pick up where you left off?
Sure. We were talking about the privatization of the liquor system in Virginia. And I was saying it was a huge priority of Governor McDonald's, and it has been one of his, or probably his biggest defeat thus far in his year-long tenure. It was defeated both because the Democrats in the Senate and the Republicans in the House, his party, did not support it. Basically, that's the bottom line. He didn't have support from either party, and it just didn't go anywhere. It didn't even get heard. The bill didn't even get heard. So,
and it was introduced by a Democrat in the House?
Well, that wasn't really an introduction in the sense of they wanted it to pass. They wanted to make the Republicans vote on it, and he did not have a House version of the bill, so they thought they would help him out.
Embarrassing.
Right. They were having fun with it. But it was really introduced in the Senate by a Republican.
Bob Roberts, what was wrong with this plan? Why didn't it go anywhere?
Number one, initially, finance, money. That was perceived as not going to bring enough revenue to replace what the state is making. And then somewhat surprisingly, and not really, it should not have been surprising to the governor, the social conservatives in the Republican Party were outraged over the prospect of many, many more outlets for alcohol. And that is not something many social conservatives want, is easier access for alcohol, where in Virginia we've had a fairly cautious approach. And so that backfired in terms of his own party.
There are 333 stores now, and it would have called for 1,000. So triple, almost.
Is he giving up, or are we going to see this again?
He says it'll be back during his term, but perhaps next year or in 2 years.
Okay, we got to talk about this White House possibility and a lieutenant position for Virginia's governor. But before we get there, Chad's been waiting patiently on the line. So, Chad, we're going to take your call next. We've got Anita Kumar, Shelley and Davis, and Bob Roberts waiting to hear what you have to say, sir.
Hi, thank you very much. I grew up in Richmond from the Fan and Bon Air, and lived in New York and New Jersey for a number of years and have come back. And I've always been fascinated by the fact that the state of New Jersey by state law, one is not allowed to pump one's own gas in gas stations, as you might have encountered if you've driven up the Jersey Turnpike.
Yes.
And so what I'm wondering is, why don't we try that in Virginia? What a great jobs bill. And I can imagine the service station owners wouldn't like it too much because they'd have to hire people. But, think about the extra, not only the jobs, but, the additional income taxes.
Dr. Roberts is a former New Yorker who I'm sure has driven through New Jersey a few times.
Do
you have any opinions on that?
I don't think the anti-regulation atmosphere in Virginia is inclined to impose this type of mandate on gasoline stations. I'll leave it at that. In other words, I don't think would regulating business and how they would pump gas would get much support in the Virginia General Assembly.
Chad, do you happen to know who your delegate or senator is for the part of Richmond you're in? Chad, are you still there, or did we lose you? Well, it was a fun suggestion. If you're still listening online, I'd love to have you go to the General Assembly's webpage and look up the delegate or senator from your area, send him this suggestion, and then have you call us back and tell us what you hear from them about that idea. Nance, we're going to go to Rocky Mount. Nancy, thank you for joining us on Assembly Conversations. Your question or comment, please, Nancy.
Yes, I'm very concerned about public broadcasting, and I'd like to know, I keep abreast on it, of the things that are going on, but it's rather confusing. I'd like to know what your commentators think of what's going on in the last couple of days, what the smoke signals are.
So you want to explain the basics, Shelley, and then see what
the governor has proposed to eliminate state funding for PBS and NPR, I think.
All public broadcasting.
And what is that, $4 or $5 million?
$4 million.
Yes. And The Senate does not want to do that, and the House has gone along with it in the budget. So that is something that will be worked out in budget conference. It has not been yet. I would suspect the difference will be somewhere in the middle. There will still be some funding, but it won't be as much as they were getting otherwise. But, I mean, I definitely think that that's kind of a trend. That's where this state government is going. If it's not a core service, then I think they're moving towards defunding it. And, you know, I think that that
he
is
tried, although he tried it last year, and it didn't happen.
Well, the House has been trying for many years to get rid of state funding of all public broadcasting. And it would seem to me that some believe that this is because of political viewpoint as much as financial theory about whether or not it's a core service. Is there legitimacy to that point of view? Is it that the Republicans in the House tend to feel, Bob Roberts, that those people who are concerned about being able to listen to NPR or to watch Big Bird on TV are not going to vote Republican anyway, so why help them out?
I think there's a perception that NPR is a arm of the Democratic Party and or liberal progressives, and therefore I think they somehow believe that you're using public funds to support a partisan political agenda. But the audience for public radio and public television goes far beyond hardcore Democrats. So I'm not sure where their perception is, except they may have listened to NPR a few times and get a negative perception from their perspective of public radio and television.
It's
And I heard also that they are cutting $1.1 million for readers for the blind. I mean,
well, it's my understanding that I probably shouldn't say this because I don't know absolutely for sure, but it had been the latest I heard is that the intention was not to cut the money for the Reading for the Blind services that generally come through NPR stations around the state, but actually to shift that to a different part of the budget. So it would still be funded, but it wouldn't come from the same place as funding for public broadcasting comes from. And that was the latest I heard. Again, the budget's in conference, so we're not sure where that's going to go. But we certainly do thank you for your question, Nancy, and for your continued support. And, of course, you know that at the national level in the U.S. House of Representatives, the Republican majority there is also trying to cut all funding for public broadcasting. Yeah. So for whatever station you listen to, hopefully you're going to do your part when their fund drive comes up.
Absolutely.
866. Thanks for your call, Nancy. 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. If you want to join Assembly Conversations with our guests, Anita Kumar from The Washington Post, Shelley and Davis from the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, and Bob Roberts from James Madison University. I believe we go next to Charlottesville. Hunter, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hey, yeah, I'm a Charlottesville student at UVA down here, and I work with the Living Wage Campaign trying to talking about the kind of wages that a lot of the workers at UVA get. And I understand that there was some talk of some change in the VRS retirement system and kind of changes in state employee pay cuts. I know that there's been a freeze on raises in the last couple of years. I was wondering if you guys could comment on what's going on with that these days.
Yeah, the status of that is both the House and Senate have basically rejected the governor's proposal to cut the amount of money that the state would put into the retirement. There's no pay cut in the governor's proposal, but what he wanted to do, much like the battle up in Wisconsin right now, require state employees to contribute into their retirement accounts, which they haven't had to since 1982. The House version would simply raise the salaries of those who are in the state VRS system and then require them to contribute 5%. The Senate version would leave everything the same. So it doesn't look like the legislature will actually reduce the salaries of classified employees by increasing or forcing them to contribute to their retirement accounts.
We just don't know yet whether it's going to be the Senate or the Assembly version of how to move forward that's going to – the Senate or the House version that's going to win out. Ladies, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I would suspect the Senate version will win out this year. They wanted more time to study the issue. It is a big change for Virginia. They also wanted more time to study the idea of I can never get this straight – defined – contribution or defined benefit, 401k type programs.
Right.
State workers don't have that now. There's the idea of introducing that, moving away from a pension system.
There was a proposal that passed the House, but killed in a Senate committee this week,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes. And so I would suspect that the end result will probably be that we do nothing this year, but that is definitely something they're looking at. That's definitely something that state employees should probably be expecting down the road. They're probably going to be asked to start contributing at some level.
Bob Roberts, is it your view that attitudes towards public employees across the nation as well as across Virginia are becoming increasingly negative? And that's part of why we're seeing some of the efforts in places like Ohio and Wisconsin to really crack down on public employee unions. But even in those states like Virginia where we don't have public employee unions, the esteem for government workers is falling?
I think it has a lot to do, I would refer to it as scapegoating, and that may be an extreme term. But what has happened is that while the income of working and middle-class Americans have remained static for the last 3 decades, and many of them lost their pensions and have been forced into 401k, which are defined contribution plans, government employees generally have kept their benefits that were put in place in the 1970s. They now look like they're better off than everybody else. And so the perception among some Americans is they haven't had to suffer like other Americans have to suffer, and why should they be privileged? You're hearing this up in Wisconsin, Ohio, et cetera. We forget that many of those benefits, those health insurance and retirement plans, were put in place in lieu of salary increases, and that was part of the negotiations that legislatures entered into back in the 70s and 80s. So Republicans have found this is a very, very effective issue. And I expect they're going to keep running with this because it does create a good deal of angst among Americans who don't have those same types of protection.
Bob Roberts, I heard something on an NPR interview earlier today, and I just want to double check and see if this is also what your reading of the statistics are. What this expert was saying is that if you compare across the board public employee salaries to private sector salaries, you see that public employees on average make a bit more than private employees. But when you compare by education level, in other words, the kind of job, and then you look at who has what level of education and what they are paid based on their level of education, that on average public employees make about 10% less than people with the same education level overall in the private sector. And then if you look at top professional jobs where the most education is involved, that public employees actually make about 20% less than people with that same higher level of education in the private sector. Do those kind of relative comparisons sound on track to you?
They're accurate with one caveat. A lot of public employees are in police, fire, education. A large percentage of state and local are in those areas.
Uh-huh.
Those aren't, except in education where you have science and math in high demand. It's not like in the private sector where the computer science people, accounting people, they're drawing the high tech salaries. So it's hard to compare saying on averages that public employees are underpaid in relationship to private sector, because the one variable which we find difficult to account for is job security. Clearly the data indicates that the layoffs in the public sector in times of recessions are much lower than the layoffs in the private sector. And that job security variable is very hard to calculate in terms of putting a dollar amount on it.
And the reason I wanted to check that with you, Dr. Roberts, is because it seems to me that I've been seeing a lot in the more commercial media comparisons that are regularly showing that public employees make significantly more than private employees. And it seems to me that there are some nuances here that maybe it's important to underscore.
Yeah, when they calculate that, what they're calculating is, what creates that number is the fact that we have a lot of low-pay retail jobs in the private sector. So we don't have a lot of low-pay jobs in the public sector. So in a sense, you have a lot of low-pay private sector jobs that bring down the average for private sector employees.
Hunter from Charlottesville, you got us thinking about lots of stuff. Thanks so much for your call. Phone number is 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. If you have thoughts or questions about the state of politics in Virginia, and in particular, what's going on with Virginia's General Assembly, next we're going to Lynchburg, where Sam has been waiting patiently. Sam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Your question or comment, please, Sam.
Well, education is very dear to my heart. My background was in engineering for years, and I tried being an engineer. I tried my hand at teaching high school math and found that was the most taxing and trying job I ever tried in my life. I've gained a great deal of respect for teachers and all of the bureaucratic things that they have to do in addition to just doing lesson plans and teaching the students. And I hear a lot of complaints about, oh, they're overpaid. I think that's one of the hardest jobs that you can have this day and age. And what's the state doing to fund education and especially special education? We've got a lot of kids that come from low-income families that desperately need more family support and get to school ready to learn. What's the state legislature doing in that regard, as well as supporting all the teachers?
And Anita Kumar from the Washington Post, in addition to Sam's question, I'd like to add in, if I could, do you find a general attitude towards education in teachers among legislators? Does it divide between conservative and liberal, Democrat and Republican? Do you find that a lot of lawmakers seem to make education a priority, or some of them think that teachers maybe make too much money?
They all run on education.
Yeah, they all talk about it all the time. I don't hear them saying they make too much money. I don't think anyone says that. But they talk about education all the time. But if you talk to the schools, the VEA, Virginia Education Association, those that represent the schools, they would say they never get enough money. They're never feeling like there's enough money in the budget. They feel like...
Is it possible that there's an education association in any other state in the union that feels it does get enough
no.
money?
No. but they have had their money cut, you know. Obviously, we've been in a recession, and obviously there have been significant budget cuts over the years. We've just now had a surplus. So it is true that over the years they have had their funding cut over the years.
And I will add that part of the Democratic argument about the surplus is that now that we have money, we should be putting money back into mm-hmm. education and reversing some of those cuts. And that's part of what the Senate budget has been trying to do. But
Sam
also,
might not have been with us at the beginning of the show. So to recap what I think you were telling us earlier, Shelley and Davis, is that the House version of the budget as it originally came out would keep funding for K-12 education essentially the same as it was last year when there were pretty steep cuts made. The Senate version would take some of that new revenue that's coming in and add more money in for K-12. Is that a
Senate version planned to add more money even before we knew how much new revenue we had? But yes, essentially that's it. The Senate has more money for K-12 and the House has less.
And what about Sam's question regarding special ed? Anything happening there?
That is not my field of expertise. But, you know, that may be something that – it's not something I hear talked about here a lot. I think that those decisions may be largely made at the state – or the local level.
Bob Roberts, you have any news on education when it comes to special ed?
No, there isn't any great influx. A lot of that special ed money comes from the federal government and under various federal entitlement programs. And the stimulus money did pour a considerable amount of money into K through 12 education over the last 2 years, which saved many school districts in the state. That money is running out. And I think what the school systems are now very much concerned about is with that federal money running out, they're not going to be in a very good position to deal with a lot of these issues the caller was talking about. In other words, unless the state comes forward. And on the Republican side, there is even support for tax credits for students who are going to private schools. We haven't heard vouchers again. There is a difference between the parties. There are many Republicans who would like to give state support for parents who would put their kids in private schools. And the Democrats are very much opposed to that.
Yeah, but that died.
I know.
Sam, thank you so much for your call. I want to let the rest of our listeners know that all of a sudden, all of our phone lines are open, but we've only got a couple more minutes to fit in and process calls and then get you on the air. So if you've got a question or comment for Anita Kumar from The Washington Post, Shelley and Davis from the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, and or Bob Roberts, public policy and politics specialist from James Madison University, please do call us right now at 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. Sam's question reminds me of something we promised earlier that we were going to get to eventually because it relates to mental health, and often special education relates to mental health. There is this whole thing with the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, coming down hard on Virginia for a certain aspect of its mental health work. Can you explain that situation, Anita?
Sure. A couple weeks ago, the Department of Justice issued a report that Virginia had long expected. I think it was 2 or 3 years in the making, and basically came down hard on the 5 training centers, which are where developmentally disabled people stay in the state. They're all over the state, and basically said that Virginia is not treating them well, and said that they should be kept better, and they should also eventually be moving out of these facilities. And the governor and the General Assembly are trying to figure out really now in these last few days, what to do. The governor has proposed that more money be spent to move some of these residents out, put them in group homes or put them in their own home and have them go to day programs. And so the House and Senate, those are one of the last few things that they're sort of arguing over. The House is recommending $30 million to start doing that.
Well, and the Senate is not necessarily opposed to that $30 million. They haven't quite agreed on how to get there and where to get that money from. And I believe that there was already a different $30 million in the governor's budget amendments. So this is another $30. It's $60 million. The idea is basically to move these people from institutional care to community-based care. And to do that, you have to have services available in the community to help
them. Which is another problem.
Which, even if they have the money, I'm not sure they have the infrastructure in place to handle that many people. So that's going to be something that's interesting going forward, and I'm not quite sure where it's going to wind up.
Okay, we've got to make room for the vice presidency thing, but Helen in Mouth of Wilson has been waiting for a while, so I'm hoping that we can get to her quickly and then not miss out on talking about the Veep stakes for our governor. Helen, where is Mouth of Wilson? That's the first time I've heard of that town.
Mouth of Wilson is where Wilson Creek runs into the New River in Grayson County, about 25 miles west from Galax.
Thank you for the geography lesson. I feel much better educated now. I bet you got a question.
I do. I'm wondering what the discussion is in the Assembly about the new state-of-the-art prison which was built in Grayson County.
And it's empty now, isn't it?
Pardon me?
It's empty now, isn't it?
It is empty now, yes. And I'm just wondering what the discussion is about its future.
Is that the one we built and then didn't use?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's in somebody's budget to utilize that. I couldn't tell you specifically, though. It's not in my coverage area, and I haven't looked closely, but I do recall seeing something like that.
But not for a prison. They're talking about finding some use for it other than correction.
No, I think it was for a prison.
Oh, really? Bob Roberts, have you heard?
I haven't heard. All I've heard is that both Republicans and Democrats would like to reduce the prison population because it costs a lot of money. And therefore, the hope for filling that facility would be closing an older one. But the problem with closing an older one, if you have that prison in your jurisdiction, you really don't want that prison closed. So I think that's probably what they're fighting about in Richmond among the criminal justice folks, whether...
But as Helen is pointing out, there is some irony in building a new supposedly state-of-the-art prison for who knows how many millions of dollars. I'm sure it was significant. And then it's staying empty, except I think for one or two people who guard it.
Right.
And Helen, I'm sorry that we don't have better information for you, but you've got all of us curious. We're going to go look it up and see if we can find some and maybe get it on the air next week.
That would be wonderful. Lots of us here would be curious.
Thank you so much for taking the time to call us. So who wants to explain how this whole thing about Bob McDonnell, governor of Virginia, possibly being a Republican candidate for vice president someday got started?
I will take a stab at it.
Okay.
So the governor has said numerous times that he is not interested in running for president or vice president. But a couple days ago on a Richmond television station, he was asked again and asked if he would run for vice president if asked by the presidential candidate, who, of course, we don't know who that is, in 2012, and he said probably. And then again today on a radio station, he said it again. And so everybody's going crazy. And the Democrats
gives us all something to talk about.
And the Democrats attacked him today and said he's just running for another office instead of being governor. And
I don't think
more
it's
to come. I'm so sorry we are out of time. And I want to mention that our guests have been Shelley Ann Davis, government and politics reporter for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Anita Kumar, politics and state government reporter for the Washington Post, and with us by phone from Harrisonburg, James Madison University professor of politics and public policy, Bob Roberts. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Graham. Thanks for tuning in. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.